Hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Events with Benefits, our podcast designed to help nonprofit organizations like yours raise more money and achieve greater success at your fundraising events. My name is Danny Hooper. I'm a professional fundraising auctioneer based in Canada and always happy to come down here to Laguna Hills, South California, to join my friends Ian Loft, the Vice President of Marketing from Winspire, and our other partner, Renee Zhao from Donation Match. Ian, good to see you again, buddy.
Good to see you too. I think you're a little tanner. You've been here for what, 16 hours now?
Yeah. I've been here from 16 hours. For 16 hours, I've been in Southern California, have not seen a single flake of snow. So this is a good trip for me. Renee, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good. We've got a good guest, another good guest on today's episode of Events with Benefits. We're going to head back down to San Diego. Again, so many of our guests seem to come from the San Diego area, and no mystery there, over 9,000 registered nonprofits in that city alone. So lots of expertise. Today we talked to Dana Levin, and she's the director of Signature Advancement Events at Jewish Family Service in San Diego. Now, Jewish Family Service San Diego, they provide a wide range of vital human services to empower people of all ages and faiths to reach their goals and build better lives. So that's their mission statement, and they need to raise a lot of money. They have a huge annual operating budget. They hold a variety of different types of fundraising events through the year, and I was just so totally impressed with her depth of knowledge when it comes to fundraising.
Absolutely. You know, lots to learn here today from Dana. She is definitely someone who has all of her ducks in a row. You can tell that she knows what she's been doing. She's been at it for a while, and she's figured out a lot of those little things that can really improve just the in-between moments in your event, really make it run smoothly. I know she's very organized, has some very, you know, tactful and very real tips for how to organize your auction items. I know their silent auction is gigantic. Did you know how many items she said were in there?
The silent auction.
Yeah, I think it was over 100.
147 last year, cut it down to 100, and she wants to shave it even more.
Yep, shave it even more down from 100. So absolutely, for those of you who are out there organizing your silent auction, listen up here. I think she's also a user of the BidPal mobile bidding platform, so she has some tips for that. So stay tuned, and again, whip out your notepad.
Yeah, and I liked Dana being able to share some of her conclusions and even the changes that she's made in the last couple of years between the events. She actually came to some conclusions and eliminated some things that other events and event leaders we've spoken to on this podcast have actually made their features. So it's actually great to get some a variety, I guess, of perspectives on the fact that her organization did better with some rather than others. And then she actually shares some about another organization's event that she attended and what she learned from that. And that's actually a great point, that attending others' events can actually give you a lot of value and definitely help you mix it up and make improvements from year to year.
Some real takeaways in this episode. So like Ian said, get your pen out and a piece of paper, and you'll want to make some notes for sure as we join Dana Levin. Well, we're delighted today to be speaking with Dana Levin, the Director of Signature Advancement Events at Jewish Family Service San Diego. That's quite a title, Dana, and maybe you can just give us a little background about what your job entails and a little bit about your organization.
Sure, it would be my pleasure. So Jewish Family Service is 99 years old here in San Diego. We're coming up on our centennial anniversary next year, which we're very excited about. And Jewish Family Service is a client-centered, impact-driven organization, and we're working to build a stronger, healthier, more resilient San Diego. We have three sort of primary areas in which we focus our work. One is to empower individuals and families to move towards self-sufficiency, to support aging with dignity, and to foster community connection and engagement throughout San Diego and the Coachella Valley. So that is sort of the scope under which we work. Although the word Jewish is in our name, we are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and we serve the entire community, not just the Jewish community. And the reason we do the work is based on Jewish values of serving people in need, but we're open to everybody throughout the community when they turn to us for help. So that's a little bit about the organization. And again, I'm the director of Signature Advancement Events, which essentially means that any event involving fundraising is managed by me and my team. So we do $1 million plus gala, golf tournament, mental health awareness luncheon, major gift dinner, et cetera.
Wow. So you've got a big mandate to fill there with those three main objectives that you outlined. Obviously, fundraising is probably top of mind for you, I would think, every day that you're coming to work. And you've very quickly touched on a few of the things that you do. What size of a budget might you folks be working with through the year?
The agency is a $19 million operating budget. So it is quite large by way of nonprofit budgets. Our budget is pulled from a variety of different sources. I help manage the individual and family giving. We also have institutional funders. We have government grants. So we have a whole different variety of revenue sources.
So your title is Director of Signature Advancement Events. Let's just highlight some of the events that you would undertake through the course of the year. Probably sounds like a fairly wide spectrum. You're going from the golf tournaments on up to the big galas, and maybe you can just touch on some of that for us.
Sure, sure. So we do $1 million plus gala. Our gala is in the spring, typically March or April, depending on the calendar. We sort of have an event season, as it seems many organizations do. For us, that really runs from about March until June. The gala this year is in April. The Mental Health Awareness Luncheon, which is a 400 to 500 person luncheon that speaks to one particular mental health issue. This year it happened to be bipolar disorder. That was in May during Mental Health Awareness Month, and then our golf tournament is in June. So it is certainly a very busy season for us, and, you know, recognizing that all of those events are planned throughout the year, but really, really we just execute during those 3 months.
Well, they all sound like they're very distinct events, Dana. How do you go about managing, planning, organizing such disparate events?
Sure. So work plans are essential, and really including everything, even the things that one doesn't really seem to think that might be so important. So, for example, if you're thinking about invitations, you know, all of those questions need to be asked around who will be involved in the process, when does a decision need to be made around design, concept, paper, all of those things. When do they need to be ordered? When do they need to be back in the office? Who's ordering the stamps? Who's affixing the stamps? Who is pulling the mailing list and when? Who's reviewing the list to ensure that you have a clean list? You know, who's coordinating the volunteers to come in and stuff all these envelopes? When will they be mailed? When will they land? You know, who will be following up to ensure key guests receive the invitations? All of those things that, you know, seem very intuitive and natural, if they're not planned, either don't happen or happen in a very rushed, meaningless way oftentimes. And so by creating a really robust work plan, you can really ensure that you and your team can be strategic about putting the event together. The other piece is, in addition to the sort of what of the work plans, you also need to ensure that you include the who. Because giving people extended notice on projects, you know, will really ensure that they can manage everything on their plate in terms of workload. And, you know, everybody in nonprofit has a lot on their plate. And, you know, surprising your database manager with a last second, seemingly quick request might really not be a big deal to you. But when everyone is working at or above capacity, you know, one little extra project is really not going to be appreciated or sometimes even possible. And, you know, that can then throw off your whole work plan when you need an essential component that's not able to be done.
Let's talk about some of
the other thing.
Oh, sorry, Dana.
Oh, sure. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Dana, I was just going to ask, what are some of the tools maybe that you use to help in your planning and your organizing? Do you do much of this stuff using online platforms, or what do you use?
So I love Excel. It's a document that we keep on our shared drive so that anybody on our team is able to go into that drive and make updates. We have not used a formal platform, although we are a Razor's Edge shop, and I know Razor's Edge can do all of these things. But for whatever reason, we haven't necessarily utilized that software in every way that it's possible. So we're a big fan of Excel spreadsheets.
Okay, very good. Well, sometimes keeping it simple is the best road to go. And obviously, it's working for you. You've been at it for a long, long time. Let's talk about timelines. How far in advance of any one of these events would you start your organizing for the upcoming year?
So obviously depends on the scope and size of the event. For our gala, it is at least a year in the making and oftentimes longer. Sometimes event dates get picked, you know, a year or two in advance, depending on the event. It also depends on the venue. So, you know, if you have a venue that you use every single year, as we do for the gala, we're always at the same Hyatt, you know, we can book out a year or two, you know, especially because we know we're going to be in the same ballroom because there are no other options. We're at the largest ballroom in the part of town where we want to be. And so, you know, there's no reason to not book in advance. We know we're doing the event, and it gives us the opportunity to really pick the best date for us as opposed to picking just from a few choices that are available, you know, a couple months before the event.
You make a very good point. So you try and go back to the events or to the venues, I'm sorry, that are working best for you. What do you change about the event itself? Do you think it's important to hit the refresh button from year to year, or are you doing the same old, and which some organizations do, and they still continue to produce results, or do you refresh it?
I think it really depends on the event, and I think it really depends on your guests and your guest experience. I think you always have to have a fresh new guest experience, even if you're having annual events and you always have the same golf tournament or you have the same gala. It really is all about guest experience. And so what we do a lot is a lot of around guest mapping. So, you know, what is a guest's first time experience from the time that they pull into the hotel until the second that they leave? What does that experience look and feel like for them versus somebody who has been to your event since its inception? You know, how do you keep them coming back, feeling engaged? This past year was year 21 of our gala, so it's a very established, prestigious, well-liked event in the community. But we really had been hearing over and over people want less time talking on stage from a formal frontal program, and they wanted to be able to schmooze and talk to both the people at their table and the other guests in the room. And so what we did was we really shortened and tightened up the program. You know, we asked a lot of questions around who absolutely has to be on the stage. You know, how many times do they have to be up there? You know, what is the essential information that we need to communicate to them? You know, really recognizing we don't want to put people up there just for political purposes. We really want to ensure that they have a meaningful reason to be up there and are communicating something that we can't tell our guests any other way. So, you know, really re-envisioning the program was a wonderful thing for us this past year, and we got exceptional feedback.
Let me ask about your experience. Based on your gala event, the Million Dollar Plus event that you do, the most effective way to trigger people emotionally and connect them to your cause, to get them to open their hearts so that the auctioneer can open the wallets, what's the most effective way to do that? Is it by spoken word, having a speaker on stage? Is it by a powerful video, or is it by print?
I think it's a combination of all those things. We moved to having a number of separate honoree videos in the past and moved to having one longer honoree video this year, really highlighting all of our honorees together in a really sort of unique concept and format. And that really spoke to our guests because they're very well-known, well-liked folks in the community. And number one, it helped in terms of quieting the crowd down, which I'm sure everybody has the problem with. But then also, it really, you know, you could look and see and touch and feel what these honorees have done as volunteers for the organization. And as a result, people were incredibly generous giving to the organization, which they knew these honorees had done so much work for. So I think, you know, it's a combination of, you know, the formal frontal, what happens on stage in terms of the speaking, in terms of the video. We, of course, have a tribute book and do print materials as well. But at the end of the day, picking the right honorees to be able to really meet your event goals is essential. And for us, those event goals are really driving people, driving revenue, cultivating donor relationships, and highlighting those three JFS impact areas I mentioned earlier.
Very good. What are some of the income streams that you have? Let's talk about your gala right now. What are some of the income streams that you incorporate through the evening? Obviously, live auction. Do you do a paddle raise or fund a need? Or what are the various money-making components?
Sure. So we have five sources of revenue for the gala. Surprisingly, one is no longer a live auction. It is one of the items that we eliminated this year, recognizing that we could probably make at or near the same amount of money from those items by putting them in the silent auction, which is what we chose to do. So the advance revenue sources are underwriting, which is more than $500,000 worth of the funding by way of revenue for the event. And of course, that includes tickets and promotion and tribute book and all of those benefits. Then individual tickets, the auction, and the fund to need. So we have all of those sort of night of. And then the other piece is what we call a non-event night gifts. So essentially, folks who know that they can't attend the event but who want to send in a donation so that particularly in honor of someone who's being honored that night, and they send in a gift, you know, so sorry, I can't be there. Here's $100 to support the organization. And so that's non-event night revenue for us. So those are the five sources.
Good. And how do you solicit that non-event night, those non-event night donations through email?
They are primarily not solicited. We have the only reason, actually, that we still send an RSVP card out with our invitation is because of these non-event night donations. Very, very few people actually mail back the physical RSVP card to say that they're joining us for the event and that they want to buy tickets. Most of the people will either go online or they'll call us, and that's how they'll purchase their tickets, or through an underwriting package. But the reason that we still send the RSVP card is for all of the non-event night donations that still come in, which is $10,000 plus.
Oh, very cool. And how about pricing your tickets? How do you set your ticket price? That's a big question that a lot of nonprofits ask, you know, when committees are sitting around doing their planning. And I often tend to think that it's sometimes easier to get more money for tickets than what people think. What's your opinion?
So I think it really depends on the market. I think you really have to look and see what other galas are charging and, you know, to sort of do some research around, you know, asking some of your key guests, would you pay this? Do you think that our gala could garner this? So we historically charge $325 for probably at least 5 years. And then about 5 years ago when I came in and started managing the gala, I bumped it to 360. 18 and 36 have meaningful relevance in the Jewish community in Hebrew. And so you'll often see different dollar amounts in increments of 18 and 36. So we made it $360. And so for us, that made a little bit more sense in terms of the funding because 325 was sort of a random number. And I don't think that there's any sort of stop and think difference between 325 and 360. And for us, when we figured out what the difference is in terms of revenue between those two amounts, it's about $9,000.
Wow. That's a great point. You know, I hail originally from Edmonton, Alberta, up in Canada, and that was home to the hockey legend Wayne Gretzky for many years, and his number was 99. And some marketing firm in Edmonton did a study years ago and found out that any time you have $99 on the end of your ticket price, whether it's $99, $199, $299, that resonated with the Edmonton audience up there. So interesting to hear your story about your pricing at $360. Now, you say you eliminated last year. You chose to eliminate your live auction. That makes my hair stand up because I'm a professional fundraising auctioneer. But nonetheless, we want people to be successful. Now, what prompted your decision to get rid of the live auction? And you still have a silent auction, obviously. So maybe you can tell us why you transitioned there.
Sure. So we did have an auctioneer, not to worry, because we do the fund to need. We call it fund to mitzvah, and that is also a significant source of revenue for us. So we did have an auctioneer do that component of the event for us on stage. Our live auction raised about $40,000, and we sort of had to weigh the time on stage in terms of what else could we do with that time in terms of the guest experience and how could we raise that money elsewhere. And so, again, we took those items, of which there were probably about five or six, that were in the 5,000-plus category that, you know, typically would have been in the live auction, and we decided to put them in the silent and to see what happened. We were in a position where we knew that we had very strong honorees, and so we felt like we had the ability to be able to, move that revenue to another budget line and recognize that even if it didn't come in a silent auction, it would still probably be more than covered in the funda mitzvah, which it was. So I suspect we'll do it again. We again found that those items sold just as well in the silent auction as they likely would have in the live. Because the people that are going to bid on those items are typically about 20% of your guests, and so the other 80% tune out. And so what we found is to create a better guest experience for everybody, we were able to still engage that 20% and allow them to bid on those items without boring the 80% who don't have the financial capability to be able to bid on those items. And for us, everything is done through mobile bidding. And so the bidding continues, you know, from the silent auction area into our ballroom. So people can sort of gauge how much they're spending, where they are with the different items before things close. So if they wanted to put in a bid on a larger item, they certainly have the ability to do that.
Great. What ratio do you use in determining how many silent auction items to go out and solicit?
That is a phenomenal question. I don't think there's a hard number or answer, at least not that I go by. We typically sell out with about 600 guests at the gala, and you know, it was for a very long time a philosophy of more is better. And what we found is more is not necessarily better. And so we got to the point where we had too many items and there wasn't enough supply and demand. And so even though we packaged some of the items together to create more robust packages, there still were too many packages. And so we originally, I think at our height, which was 2 years ago, we had 147 packages. And of course, I'm sure, as you know, a package could be one item, a package could be 10 items, sort of depending on what it is. And so it's a lot of back-end work for the staff to put all those items together. It's a ton of work for the volunteers to go out and solicit them. And so what we found was we were only getting a handful of bids on certain items. And so what we decided to do was eliminate some of those items for the next year. And so 2 years ago, we had 147 packages, which was way too many. This past year, we went down to 100, and that felt much better. I would love for us to go down to 75, truthfully, but we have so many incredible items and so many generous donors and companies that I'm not sure 75 is actually going to be possible, but maybe somewhere between 75 and 100 feels right.
But you did definitely notice an uptick in your income from the silent auction once you lowered the number of items in the silent. Is that right?
We did, because we found that there was more of a supply and demand fight for items, and so people were feeling more invested in winning particular items or packages because, you know, previously we had maybe 4 trips to Cancun, and by eliminating 2 of them, you know, people felt more connected to really want to get one of those 2 packages as opposed to saying, oh, you know, I'll maybe get the other one and, you know, who knows. So we found that there was definitely more competition, and because everything is done on a mobile bidding platform, we use BidPal, we found that, you know, it's completely anonymous, so you don't feel badly, you know, seeing the person's name on the line above you and saying, oh, you know, I want my friend Joe to get the trip. You know, everything's anonymous, everything's through the phone, and it works very, very well for us.
Oh, that's interesting. So your mobile bidding, which is really starting to gain a lot of traction all across North America and around the world, people seem to love it and are adopting it easily. We're hearing reports of revenues increasing sometimes 25-30% and more in the silent auction when people go to a mobile bidding platform, and you say that you're doing it completely anonymously, so you don't enable that function on the mobile bidding for people to put in their names. It's all anonymous, huh?
Correct. Everything's anonymous. Everybody is assigned a bid number, so that number then sticks with them for the entire night in terms of processing registration, mobile bidding on the silent auction, funda mitzvah, which is our funda need for the paddle raise. It's the same number. So we have 2-digit numbers for certain items, 3-digit numbers for all auction items, and 4-digit guest numbers. And so we're able to track what number goes with who based on the number of digits. And that seems to work very well for us.
So you do use it for your funda mitzvah then? You use the mobile bidding?
So we do a live fund a need, fund a mitzvah. So people have the opportunity to put up their physical bid card at whatever level they'd like to give. We do also offer the option for folks who don't want that public recognition or who don't want that peer pressure element to be able to make a gift on their BidPal through their phone of any amount.
Wow, that's a real important point you've shared with us, and I would just like to expand on that a little bit. I'm a fundraising auctioneer and was doing an event in Calgary up in Alberta, Canada there not long ago, and they were using the mobile bidding and they wanted to do the cash appeal, what we call a cash appeal or the fund a need or fund a mitzvah, whatever, the paddle raise. They wanted to do it exclusively on the tablets, have people go to their tablets, but they wanted me to get up there and really generate some excitement and say, all right, who will give $5,000? And instead of having people put up their hands, they wanted me to say, okay, if you'll give $5,000, please pick up your tablet and do it now. And it was just dead. The results were disastrous because a big part of what makes the paddle race so successful is lots of times maybe there's a little ego or whatever you call it, but sometimes people appreciate that recognition when they're giving money in larger amounts, and that sometimes prompts other givers in the room to step forward and participate as well, and you build that energy and excitement. This is obviously something you've had lots of experience with, Dana, and have decided to run your fund a mitzvah the way that you do. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
Sure. The other thing that we have found works very well, and as the on the event side of things, makes me feel much better as both a fundraiser and event planner, is making sure that you have a guaranteed gift at the top. There's sort of two camps or philosophies around this. So I always only will start the fund a need at the top level where I have a guaranteed gift. So again, for us, you know, we start the giving at 36,000, we go to 18,000, you know, and down from there in increments of 18s. But you know, it really works in any amount. But if your top gift is confirmed at say $50,000, to me, that's where you open the bidding. I've been to many other events and other fundraisers feel very differently. You know, they feel like if you start the bidding where you have a guaranteed gift, you potentially could be leaving money on the table, which, you know, I understand their point in their philosophy, but the crickets in the room feeling feels awful to everybody when, you know, you go around and you ask, is there anybody who wants to make an opening bid, and there is nothing. I mean, I'm sure as an auctioneer, you know, that is an energy killer.
I can tell you as an auctioneer, the feeling for me is very much like standing there with my pants down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a horrible feeling. It really is, you know, and like you call it the crickets in the room. It's just there's nothing worse. And you know, the odd time you'll get at an event where you're down asking people to raise their hand at $1,000, nobody's putting a hand up. So it can be very awkward and very uncomfortable. But I think what you're talking about here, where you know that you have a guaranteed gift, that is, in essence, what you're doing is priming the pump.
Correct.
And that's just a great thing, a great takeaway for our listeners on this particular episode. If you're planning a paddle raise or a fund an item or fund a need, is do a little legwork prior to the event. See if you can get a commitment from one of your supporters or more of your supporters to step forward during the cash appeal portion of the evening. And you're absolutely right. If those paddles go up in the air right out of the gate, that just makes for a far more successful and exciting cash appeal. So. Great. Let's just talk about managing your back end and getting people out the door at the end of the evening.
Sure.
How do you do it?
In terms of silent auction?
Just paying for their auction purchases and for their pledges that they have made. Now, of course, if you're using mobile bidding, I guess they can pay for their items on the tablets. Is that right? Or using their phones?
Correct. So we really encourage upon registration for people to swipe a credit card. And the question that is essential to be asked is not would you like to leave a credit card with us this evening for your purchases, but which credit card would you like to leave this evening for your purchases? Because what we found is when you ask people that, they're like, oh, you know, Visa, MasterCard, you know, they're picking between two as opposed to, no, you know, I'll just deal with it later. So we found that we typically get about 80 to 90% of our guests have built up a trust in us and in the mobile bidding system that we use to recognize, you know, of course, we're not going to charge them if they don't win anything. And also the beauty of this system that we use, again, called BidPal, is that we are in control of when the credit cards get charged. So everything gets swiped on the way in an ideal world. For us, again, that's about 80 to 90% of guest credit cards. So at the end of the night, we have the opportunity for guests to either go to straight to pickup, or they have to maybe go back and pay. Again, we have a handful of guests that need to go back and pay, so that line is typically very short. It's the pickup line that is typically much longer, as you can imagine. So we have a great system down for reorganizing the items by categories. So all the items that are 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 in terms of numbers. And then what we have is probably five or six volunteer shoppers who in the silent auction area will go through as soon as a guest comes up and they say, hi, you know, my name is Dana Levin, I'm guest 123. We have a shopper who can take a monogrammed bag from them from the event, and somebody says, okay, great, they've purchased item 469 and package 142. The shopper goes, picks out those two items, and then they're able to hand them to the winning bidder. That seems to be a great flow and process for us. The other thing that we do that is really wonderful by way of guest experience, particularly when there's a slightly longer line, is that we have a Nespresso coffee bar and a fresh hot donut bar right as guests are walking out to go pick up their items. And so guests really appreciate that, you know, while they're waiting in line, they can have an espresso and they can eat their donuts. And anytime you give guests fried sugary dough, they're happy even if they have to wait a few minutes for their items.
Oh, that's excellent. I just want to get back very quickly to talking about the registering the credit cards on entry to the event when guests are coming in. That is linked, of course. That is linked, of course, to your mobile bidding platform. Isn't that right? So it's all automatic.
Correct.
Yeah. So that is so slick. And once again, it's BidPal that you use.
Correct. We've been very happy with BidPal. And again, the thing that really sets BidPal apart from some of the other companies in terms of the payment and processing is that they don't have a magic time frame of 24 or 48 hours by which the credit cards have to get charged. We're able to go through manually and charge the credit cards as we wish and when we wish. So, for example, during the Fund a Mitzvah, many of our guests would like to pay for their commitment through a donor-advised fund. And for most of them at this point, we know who they are, and you know, we recognize that they want to do that, and we follow up the next day and ask them if they want to do that. But generally, we're not going to charge their credit card and then have to deal with a bunch of refunds. We're able to only charge the cards that we want and for whatever the amount is. So if somebody puts up their bidder number for $1,000 during Fund a Mitzvah, and that's fully tax-deductible, which can be paid out of their donor-advised fund, and they also win a $500 auction item that is not tax deductible, so that we can charge on their credit card, but we only charge the $500. We don't charge the $1,000 because we know that that's going to come from their other fund.
Oh, very interesting. Sounds like you've got this entire process finely tuned. Any other insights that you might want to share, or little tips or strategies, things that are working well for you?
Sure. I think that, you know, you really have to ask yourself what makes your event unique. I had talked about the guest mapping, so really look at a first-time guest experience or someone who's been, you know, to your event forever. What does that guest experience look like? And really, what can you do to make different types of guests feel special? So maybe there's a special sticker or pin or something on their name tag that makes them feel unique and different and special, and it also triggers a conversation. So if somebody's been giving to an organization for 25 years, you know, you can put some sort of designation on their name tag, and it sparks conversation. The other thing is you can also put a special note at their seat or recognize them on signage. Or somebody who's a monthly donor. We've really been looking to try and increase our monthly, that we call them momentum donors. We've really looked to try and increase that campaign. So how can we recognize those folks on signage or by a special note at their seat? We have welcome greeters throughout the event. So that is always a really nice way to both welcome people at the beginning. We also have exit greeters at the end to ensure that from start to finish, people have a really wonderful experience. And really, exit greeters are the last opportunity you have to thank your guests that night. So that's a really essential component to making your event feel really special and unique. You also can have a VIP registration line. If there's any sort of speaker or entertainment. You can have some sort of special meet and greet. The other thing that we really love to do is a couple of days after the event, people get a thank you call from somebody in the C-suite, so one of our C-level staff members, and that makes people feel really wonderful as well.
Wow, Dana, lots to digest here. I love it. You obviously have all your ducks in a row. This is Ian from Windspire here. Wanted to get your thoughts before we let you go here. Just curious if you've used consignment travel before. Doesn't have to be from us, but from anyone. What your thoughts about using it in the auction? I know you guys have shied away from the live auction and done it into the silent auction. But do you use any consignment items in your silent auction?
So up until this year, the answer was no. We have really, really phenomenal connections to different travel agencies and different folks in that arena, and we've been able to get all of the trips donated. This year, we found that we had a couple of gaps in the packages that we wanted to offer. We really wanted a Hamilton in New York package, and so we did end up using a consignment company for that package. And it was a good experience. I think we would do it again. Obviously, you know, the ROI really has to be there. And with consignment, it's much harder because we're paying so much more. We're paying something for the item. But that has been really my only experience recently with consignment items.
Well, we always suggest, too, that for my role as a fundraising auctioneer, you know, if we're recommending consignment to our clients, we say go out and find an underwriter, you know, somebody that will underwrite the cost of that consignment package. So then it does become pure profit for the organization, and we've been getting great results with that.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion.
Yeah, it is, because then, you know, you got a local car dealer maybe going to underwrite that Hamilton package. That's a lot sexier donation for the business owner to make, you know, than maybe sometimes just a straight cash donation. It gives them a chance to leverage their giving as well. So anyway, well, that's great, Dana. I tell you, you are just a wealth of information and knowledge here. Is there anything else that you wanted to cover before we cut you loose here?
Well, Renee and I were talking a little bit earlier about my favorite event. So
yeah.
If you have a few minutes, I'm happy to tell you about that.
Good. Let's do that. A little case study.
Sure, sure. So it's actually not a JFS event. This was an event many years ago that I went to. And it was actually the Food Banks Gala. And it was fascinating because it was a phenomenal guest experience. The event took place in their warehouse where they store the pallets of food, and they literally just moved all of the pallets to the exterior of the building and put all of the tables and the dance floor and everything in the center. But it was a really phenomenal way to literally see and feel and touch the work that they do and the food that they serve, because you were surrounded by it. You could not miss what they do. So that was really, really impactful. Also, each course of the dinner was prepared by a different chef, and so each chef came around during their course and interacted with the guests, which made everybody really feel like a VIP guest at that event. They also had a very short program, not a lot of talking heads, which was wonderful. They also had a very recognizable chair, Lisa Busalaki, who is a longtime San Diegan, whose family owns the Busalaki family of restaurants. And I'm sure she leveraged her network to secure a lot of guests and auction items. So there was a very recognizable chair, and she was the one who was on stage most of the time. It was not the professional staff, which I thought was very, very smart on their part. The other thing that they did was their silent auction was a great bidding experience, and it was really before mobile bidding was a thing. So it was very impactful to see on the back end how did their bidding work and what was this, what was the pickup like, because it was very organized and it was very easy for guests. And then finally, the last thing that they did that was really wonderful was that it was a weeknight event, so everybody, of course, you know, wanted to get home out and early. And so they served coffee and tea on the way out as guests got into their cars versus at the tables. And I thought that that was just brilliant in terms of a time saver.
Wow. Very good. Well, I'm going to kind of put you on your toes here right now. You're obviously brilliant when it comes to discussing events and fundraising. What would three tips be, or three pieces of advice that you would pass along to our audience, which is made up largely of fundraising nonprofits, anything from little school groups on up to the health foundations and whatnot that do the biggest of the big galas. So what are three takeaways or tips that you might offer our listeners?
So the biggest thing, again, is having a plan and having a good work plan, then also to plan in advance and then plan for the worst. So you never know what's going to happen, but if you can plan in advance and have a really great plan, my key item is that the 2 days before the event, I try and plan absolutely nothing to be done. Everything should be completed in advance. And then if you happen to be sitting around twiddling your thumbs, then your whole team goes out for lunch and has a pre-celebration before the event. But the reality is, as most of us know, is there's always some sort of last-minute crisis that was completely unavoidable. And so you then have the time to be able to manage that crisis, whatever it happens to be, whether, you know, a $10,000 table comes in at the last second and you have a sold-out event, or a major donor says, you know, I'm now bringing my granddaughter and, you know, all of your tables are 12 and now you've got to figure out what to do with a 13th guest, or an honoree cancels and an honoree gets sick. I mean, life just happens. And so, you know, thinking through all of these strategies in advance is really helpful, but having those 1 to 2 days in advance where if something happens, you have the time and the space to be able to deal with that is absolutely a game changer for us.
All right. Well, fabulous. Our guest today has been Dana Levin, Director of Signature Advancement Events at Jewish Family Service in San Diego. And Dana, we thank you so much for sharing your time and more importantly, your expertise with us here today. It's been very, very helpful for our listeners, I'm sure.
Sure. It's my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the show this week. For show notes, special offers, or to listen to previous episodes, you can visit us at eventswithbenefits.com. Please also consider subscribing to our podcast on iTunes. And if you enjoyed the show, do us a favor and write us a review while you're there. If you have any questions or feedback, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email at hosts@eventswithbenefits.com. We'll see you next time.